David, it's wonderful how every pub we pick always has a piano and a guitar. Which are you going to play this week? Which are you going to play? I'll do the piano.
Nice.
Hey, you took me by surprise. That was good. Yeah.
Once again,
playing with the fourth wall.
Yeah. We are a couple of hilarious gents. This is another one of your interviews, David.
It's the second
of a theorist series. And last week we had Robert Segal on Carl Gustav Jung. This week we have Paul-François Tremblay on Claude Lévi-Strauss.
Yeah. And the importance of denim jeans in the study of religion.
Oh, I'm wearing them.
Never. I will never be seen in pantaloons de nîmes.
Well, that's up for debate. Take it away, David.
Claude Lévi-Strauss is a seminal figure in the history of anthropology and is considered the father of structural anthropology. But sometimes his theories can be quite difficult to get your head around at first. To talk about Lévi-Strauss and structural anthropology and his importance to religious studies, I'm joined today by Paul-François Tremblay. Welcome to the Religious Studies Project.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
Well, not at all. You literally wrote the book on Lévi-Strauss on religion. And you can plug that later, don't worry. We should point out that we're here at the Open University's Contemporary Religion and Historical Perspective Conference. It's the end of the conference. We don't have a nice room to record in, so we're out in the foyer. So if there's background noise, that's why. If we don't make any sense, that's why. We're going to the pub as soon as we finish this. So it might not be very long. But should we start with Lévi-Strauss? As a person, maybe?
I think we should start with Lévi-Strauss and why he's important for religious studies. Because we were talking earlier, and you were saying that quite often students encounter Lévi-Strauss in quite a limited way in their studies. Maybe they get one lecture, and maybe they only read one or two pieces by Lévi-Strauss, and that would typically be on his chapter on the Oedipus myth. The thing is, Lévi-Strauss is a really good entry point to understand anthropology. Much of Lévi-Strauss's work is directed to interpreting classical anthropology. It also anticipates some developments in contemporary anthropology of religion, particularly cognitive theories of religion. Lévi-Strauss is interested in the human mind, is interested in how it works. In my book, the subtitle of the book is The Structuring Mind. Lévi-Strauss is very much indebted to a sort of Kantian idea of the mind and the way it structures the way that we encounter the world.
Okay. So his early work, I think, was mostly to do with kinship, wasn't it?
Yeah, his first major work is on kinship. And for Lévi-Strauss, kinship is essentially communication. One of the things that Lévi-Strauss does throughout his career, starting there, is he's very interdisciplinary anthropologist. Mm-hmm. Not only is he reflecting on the tradition of anthropology, he's also drawing on theories of language, Saussurean linguistics, Jakobson, these kinds of people. He's also drawing on work of people like Norbert Wiener, who start developing theories of cybernetics. Mm-hmm. He's interested in notions of entropy, recursive systems, feedback loops. So for Lévi-Strauss, kinship is a system of exchange. Now, you know, this upsets some feminists because in Lévi-Strauss's theory, the things, if you like, being exchanged, or the messages being exchanged, are women.
Mm-hmm.
They're being exchanged from one group to another. So let's say we have two groups, Group A and Group B. Group A cannot marry women from Group A. That would be incest.
Mm-hmm.
So they marry women from Group B. Likewise, Group B has to marry the women from Group A. Otherwise, it would be incest.
Yeah.
And you can see certain, you know, with the, by bringing up the idea of incest, we can see that Levi-Strauss is also drawing on classical European notions, Freudian notions of the sort of decisive moment when humans become cultural, is through the instantiation of the incest taboo. From there, then women become the means for groups to communicate with each other through the exchange of women. Now, obviously, this did upset a lot of people, feminist anthropologists, because women were essentially objects or messages that were being exchanged by men. So there's been some interesting critiques of Levi-Strauss's work on kinship. One of the ones that I was particularly keen on was McKinnon in a book called Relative Values. And basically, she tried to show that actually Levi-Strauss is giving us quite a conservative, basically, approach to kinship. But I think, although Levi-Strauss's work on kinship is interesting and gives us a sense of some of the ideas that he'll draw on later, what's more important for students in religious studies, I think, is his work on myth. So in the essay The Structural Study of Myth, Levi-Strauss focuses on the Oedipus myth, and I think what's really fascinating about that particular chapter is that what Levi-Strauss is doing is basically saying, look, the first point is that there's never one single, let's say, original or true version of a myth. What we're interested in is comparing all the different versions of the Oedipus myth. Because what happens across those versions is certain subtle changes in the way the myth is organized.
Okay.
What Levi-Strauss tries to do is show how myths are structured, but also how those structures start to shift, start to change, and start to transform.
Okay.
One of the ways in which structuralism has been commonly received in a lot of secondary literature is that structuralism is all about fixed systems.
Yeah.
Actually, and this is where the link, I think, comes into more contemporary theory, is that actually what structuralism is all about is about transformations. If we think about a fractal or even chaos theory, what's happening there is when certain little nudges or minor events occur, a system can radically change in the way it's organized.
Yeah.
And that's what Levi-Strauss is interested in with myths. He's interested in the way transformations occur in culture, in myths, and also, of course, in kinship systems. So Levi-Strauss is not only looking back on anthropology, rereading the canon, he's also anticipating some future developments in anthropology, but not just anthropology, in some of the wider social sciences.
Yeah.
And I think it makes him a really interesting figure in the 20th century. You know, it's not just 20th century study of religion or anthropology of religion, it's 20th century social theory. We need to see Levi-Strauss as a person contributing to Western European debates about politics, about kinship, about culture, about religion. I think he's a really key point of entry into trying to get a handle on a vast array of ideas, concepts, and practices. And I definitely encourage students to get to grips with his work.
I can certainly see a number of obvious kind of... I'm guessing people he's influenced. The subtitle there, the structured... Structuring mind, to me, recalls Bourdieu, his idea of structuring structures.
Yeah.
And that's maybe a development of Levi-Strauss to have that system influencing both ways. So it's not just that the mind is influencing the structure, but that structure is feeding back then into the...
Yeah, I mean, Bourdieu is a good call for the kind of if we want to look at the influence of Levi-Strauss's work and of structuralism on other thinkers that we might encounter in our studies. Bourdieu, Michel Foucault, Jacques Derrida, these kinds of people were profoundly influenced by Levi-Strauss's work mm-hmm. and methods. I mean, you know, Levi-Strauss was himself influenced by Saussure's linguistics, and one of the key points about Saussurean linguistics is that signs, words,
indeed,
don't refer to objects in the world, they actually just refer to other signs, and that's one of the key insights of Derrida's approach to language, mm-hmm. of deconstruction. Mm-hmm. And if we think about Michel Foucault's work, particularly archaeology, is very much about, and also his the essay The Order of Discourse, these are, although Michel Foucault consistently denied being a structuralist, mm-hmm. Nevertheless, I think there's strong grounds for reading these works as structuralist works, or as being deeply inflected by structuralist right. ideas.
Is there a relationship between Levi-Strauss's structuralism and, say, actor network theory in later sort of European sociology? The way you said there, you know, that for Levi-Strauss and some of the people who followed him, symbols didn't refer to concrete things, they just referred to symbols. Now, if you take it to actor network theory, then those symbols become agents within that larger system and are things which are capable of affecting behaviour and acting as agents within the system. Am I making connections that aren't there?
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, I've read some Latour, and it's unclear to me if he is what the influence of structuralism or Levi-Strauss is on his work. I mean, one of the things that Latour does is essentially decenter the human. And what's interesting is that structuralism, Levi-Strauss's work, one of the key accusations made by critics was they accused it of anti-humanism.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, there's a fabulous quote with Levi-Strauss talking about myth. He says, I claim to show not how men think in myths, but how myths operate in men's minds. Mm-hmm. Clearly, the agency is being given to myth. A lot of people were quite upset by this. Another thing that he does is if we were contrasting a phenomenological, perhaps, approach to myth, the phenomenologist might be hoping to distill some kind of meaning.
Mm-hmm.
The only meaning for Levi-Strauss is that the myth always leads you to another myth. It always is always a transposition of something else. It's always a journey somewhere else. Myth just lead to other myths.
Yeah.
So there, it's not like there's no connection with Latour, but I'm uncertain about how strongly we can draw mm-hmm. that. I mean, I think the comparison with Bourdieu is quite interesting, though. Bourdieu, in his work, is struggling with phenomenology, the idea that the field informant it can be seen as a faithful narrator of their own experience. That might be the phenomenological insight.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, there's the structuralist insight, that we are products of systems and structures, not of our making. And of course, both of those, what Bourdieu tries to do is negotiate both of those points of view
mm-hmm.
to
mm-hmm.
create his own theory of,
yeah.
of practices and habitus.
And habitus, yeah. That's interesting. In Levi-Strauss's structuralist approach to myth, then, are we looking at something which looks forward to cognitive studies, in that myth is a way that humans are predisposed to think, perhaps? Or is it more of an Eliadian kind of Jungian idea, where they're underlying all of these varieties of myths, there's a monomyth, perhaps? Or is it kind of both?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, to try and link Eliade, for example, to a kind of structuralism is an interesting move. I mean, the Eliade is a structuralist, but he's not a structuralist in the same way that Levi-Strauss is. He's interested in structures, but for him, they're primordial structures, they're sacred structures.
There's just one structure as well, that's the other thing.
That's right. And with Levi-Strauss, what he's interested in, and that, you know, there's a classic division that's quite old in anthropology, that, you know, there's modernity, characterized by particular cognitive dispositions. And then there's what was before modernity, characterized by other cognitive dispositions. And it's those other cognitive dispositions that Lévi-Strauss is interested in. He calls those la pensée sauvage, in English, savage thought. And that the disposition of la pensée sauvage is something he calls bricolage, which is a bit like collage in art, that people make, let's say, make myths out of the resources they have to hand. It's not necessarily entirely systematic or conceptual in the same way that an engineer might work in modern industry or something like that, but it's a particular mode of intellectual assembly, a particular cognitive disposition, and that orientation that we see in early anthropology, for example, E.B. Tyler, to focus on thinking, modes of thinking and its relation to religion, we see that in Lévi-Strauss, and we're seeing that in more recent work in the anthropology of religion by Pascal Boyer, by Harvey Whitehouse, by Scott Atran, and even in New Atheist writing, Dawkins, obviously, and Daniel Dennett, and so on.
Let's think of the guy that wrote... Faces in the Clouds as well. You know that one?
Guthrie,
Stuart Guthrie, that's right. That's interesting.
I actually think Lévi-Strauss' work is more dynamic than much of that. It's a more dynamic, let's say, picture of the mind than you find in Pascal Boyer. Pascal Boyer is like a clockwork mind.
Yeah.
We inherited a mind from our ancestors, from our early human ancestors, and that mind is just fixed and ready to go. It doesn't matter which culture or historical moment or society it's immersed in or that it develops in. He's not interested in development. It's all the bits are there, and off it goes.
Is he operating within any kind of evolutionary framework?
Well, Lévi-Strauss is very concerned to try and break from that. He saw the evolutionary models of early anthropologists like Tyler, Fraser, and others as a real problem for anthropology. Anthropology was always supposed to be about trying to understand the point of view of other people as much as possible from their point of view. You had to try and understand, if you like, la pensée sauvage from the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And Lévi-Strauss says several times, that's what I'm trying to do, even though he's often accused of sort of super detachment.
Yeah.
So he wanted... For Lévi-Strauss, he's extremely, for example, in if you read Triste Tropique, which is kind of an autobiographical narration of his fieldwork in South America, he's extremely critical of colonialism, of Western society, Western decadence. It's quite a moving book. And I think, you know, when you read some of his monographs or anthropological essays, they're often couched in quite a technical and sometimes quite opaque language. They're sometimes quite difficult and quite taxing to read because they seem to resist easy interpretation. When you read Triste Tropique, you're reading something very literary, very humane, very accessible, and very empathetic, and very having quite a profound actual insight into European mores as well as the cultures that he's actually interested in Brazil.
Just to go back to the previous question, I mean, I didn't realise that he had originated the term bricolage. Now, bricolage has, of course, had a sort of second life in the post-70s Colin Campbell, new religious movements and new age field. Also, more recently, I come across it a lot in looking at conspiracism, for instance, in terms of people talking about bricolages of these influences from all different places. Now, is that the same way he used it? And if it is, can we therefore... Could you do a Lévi-Strauss interpretation? Could you use Lévi-Strauss's model to understand this kind of modern spiritual supermarket?
Well, I mean, I'm not familiar with the literatures, and I know that you're interested in, but I've also seen the word bricolage being used by people like Meredith Maguire when they're talking about lived religion, when they're talking about vernacular religiosities. There's this sense that religions are sort of fabricated in an alternately consciously and an unconscious way out of bits and pieces that come to hand. that's sometimes the word bricolage is sometimes used in these kinds of contexts, often without reference to Levi-Strauss.
Yeah.
I'm curious. Levi-Strauss tries to be clear about what bricolage is and under what circumstances it takes place. So he's actually delimiting the term. He's saying, this is what bricolage is, this is when it occurred, this is the kind of thing it is. But when I've seen it in, for example, in these other contexts, talking about lived and vernacular religiosities, that attempt to limit the term or provide a context for what it's taken to mean is absent.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's just become a sort of free floater for creativity.
Yeah.
In my view, it doesn't mean creativity. It means something rather more circumscribed, rather more limited than that.
So in Levi-Strauss it would mean actually that things are put together, but the word, it refers to the limited pool from which these things are drawn.
Yeah.
That are the cultural elements,
yes.
The mythological elements that you inherit from this social structure.
Absolutely. So, you don't, for Levi-Strauss, the peoples that he's interested in do not have this apparently infinite repertoire of cultural resources to draw upon. They actually mm-hmm. have much more limited cultural resources.
Yeah.
It's perhaps globalization that's given us this privilege of massive cultural coalition, something that Levi-Strauss, by the way, was extremely interested in, but massive cultural coalition, which expands the kind of resources that we can draw upon.
Yeah.
We're used to going to supermarkets or surfing the internet and seeing all kinds of images and commodities juxtaposed, and we seem to be able to make all kinds of choices about objects that may come from cultures we've never have no personal experience of or belief systems or philosophies we have no personal understanding of, and yet we can take images or purchase objects that come from those or putatively come from those sort of locations. So I don't think bricolage means for Levi-Strauss what it's come to mean in more contemporary discussions and debates.
Yeah, yeah. I was wondering, the mythological model that Levi-Strauss uses in, is it mythologique? Is that how it's pronounced? The four-volume series?
Yeah.
Where he takes the one myth and follows it, version from version.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right the way around the world, or from North to South Pole, anyway. Has anyone tried to do a similar analysis of the world religions, say, and, try and go to the narratives of it and follow their evolution from, across space and time and see if you could do a similar sort of analysis?
I can't answer that question. I really don't know. I mean, what Levi-Strauss is mostly interested in is how these myths essentially morph into one another,
mm-hmm.
how they transform.
Yeah.
And I think that first volume, which I think is The Raw and the Cooked, it's a fabulous introduction into the dynamism of structuralism. The mm-hmm. fact that it's not about fixed systems, it's about transformations taking place. Just as small, what he calls mythemes, these little units of mythic meaning, as they're combined in slightly different ways, they're a bit like attractors. People talk about strange attractors and chaos theory, and as they're combined in slightly different ways, the myths are consequently transformed until at the end of the series, there's no. The end of the series doesn't look like the beginning.
You've
got these transformations taking place from myth to myth to myth across all the different versions of the same myth as well, and it's extremely dynamic, it's extremely vital, and employing he was not drawing on anthropology, he was drawing on cybernetics, theory of entropy. Levi-Strauss is an extremely well-read individual, drawing on science, anthropology, reading studies of mysticism and religion, and really gave us, really gave us something to think about. And I think in religious studies we've tended to overlook his work because it's partly because it's difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
Partly because it's difficult. I think that's
partly. I think there's a tendency in religious studies to overlook the European, particularly the European sociologists, but perhaps the anthropologists as well, because they have a different, sometimes abstruse style, but sometimes a poetic kind of style as well that we don't seem to be drawn to in quite the same way.
Yeah, that's probably right. I mean, you know, one of the wonderful things he does in his work on myth is also make some fantastic allusions to music and you know, the way, let's say, a symphony might be essentially a study in a particular key, and the transformations through the symphony are for Levi-Strauss parallels to the way myths transform themselves. And, you know, at the end, you know, he's interested in meaning, and he accuses his contemporaries of expecting to find, you know, myths imbued with what he calls mysticism. And then he says, they hold it against me that the extra meaning I distill from the myths is not the meaning they would have liked to find there. They refuse to recognize and to accept the fact of their deafness to the great anonymous voice whose utterance comes from the beginning of time in the depths of the mind. I mean, that kind of writing, for me, I find that very evocative, very powerful, very suggestive. But it's also, in a way, quite disturbing, because he, as I said before, he decenters our senses of agency, our sense of creativity, and he locates it elsewhere, to the myths themselves, for example. And I think, you know, that makes his work difficult, but also I think if you persevere with it, extremely rewarding, not least because it gives you such, if nothing else, such great insight into the history of anthropology as a discipline, but also the influence on social theory, Bourdieu, Derrida, and the others that we've talked about.
Well, I think that's the perfect place to end, and to be honest, the place is starting to fill up now, yeah. So we'd be drowned out soon, but that's a fascinating...
Well, it's time for a drink.
It is absolutely time for a drink, and that's one unit of culture which I think has continued unchanged for a long time. So,
okay.
So I'll say thanks, Paul, and I will say goodbye to everybody else.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me.
You're welcome.
Okay, so now...
That was good fun, that interview. I worked Paul pretty hard that weekend. That was at the Open University's, what was it called, the Contemporary Religion in Historical Context.
Yeah, you got a round table out of that, which we had.
Well, I did the round table, which Paul me and Paul organised it. Paul kind of chaired it. I also interviewed Paul. I did Ronald Hutton, John Wolfe.
They're in the same interview, so the same.
Was there somebody else?
I think that was all.
Yeah,
sorry if I forgot.
That's quite a lot for 48 hours. Yeah.
It was. Very pleased to work.
So yeah, Paul was complaining about how hard I worked him. But yeah, so you can hear it in our voices at the end of that. I think. towards the end, you can hear all the other. I know that Steve Sutcliffe and Marion Bowman are both in the background of that. Ready for their post-conference drinks. So we decided we better wrap up hastily. So hey, it means we've got a bit of time at the end of this week's episode.
Exactly. Just before I forget, we should thank the BASR, as always, and the Open University, who facilitated you going down there.
Recordings.
Something I thought we should introduce this week. We'll see how it goes. I mean, it's more just to let you know what's going on. There's quite a lot of activity happening in the comments section on the website, and as we don't really have a sort of listeners emails corner or anything like that, I thought maybe we could start introducing some of the comments that people were making on the website, sort of as an interesting thought-provoking exercise, and also to remind you of some of the podcasts that are up there. I have literally just picked this as at random, but this is a response from Sarah at Wilfrid Laurier University in Canada. Who are actually using they're using the website as sort of a tutorial exercise, so we've been getting a lot of comments from there. She was commenting on our interview with Donald Weeb, mm-hmm. which was on the...
That was quite a long time ago.
It was quite a long time ago. Yeah, I recorded that back in September 2011, which is on theology and religious studies. And she writes, well, this is certainly a bleak assessment of the field of religious studies. Religious studies departments are still fairly new, and their reported failure thus far to fully differentiate themselves from their theological origins does not mean that the project should be jettisoned entirely. While it's not unreasonable to ask that scholars of religion try to, quote, bracket, unquote, their personal beliefs and achieve some measure of objectivity, it seems that in a field that relies to some extent on textual analysis of religious literature and empathetic understanding of religious adherence, a strict separation of theology from, quote, religious studies, unquote, may be unachievable and unproductive. That being said, this argument opens up an important debate about the nature of religious studies and could potentially add dynamism to the field by making space for new disciplines and methodologies. That's sort of quite a thorough comment there. And, you know, Don Weave's view is it is bleak in some senses.
Yeah.
But I would always stand by that need to have a strict separation between a...
I would too, and I think it's important. I can't remember if this was mentioned in the response at the time, but it's important to understand the difference between the US situation and the situation elsewhere in the world. I mean, in Britain particularly, it's not so much a case of theology encroaching on religious studies as religious studies encroaching on theology, or so it often feels. Where you have, you know, for instance, our alma mater, Edinburgh, had a theology department for hundreds of years before this upstart religious studies came along and started telling it how it should be, you know, how we should be doing this.
Absolutely. And, you know, we've always got to remember that theology is data, after all. But anyway, that was Sarah's response. There are dozens more of these up on the site, and that might hopefully inspire you to maybe revisit the Weeb podcast if you haven't listened to it already, and do join in these things as well. We only present, you know, one view, say. Every interviewee, every response, it's that person's view. So
I've got another one for you if you fancy.
Yeah, let's do it.
It's by Christine Pugh. I think it's how you pronounce it.
Yeah.
Another Wilfrid Laurier student. And she's talking about Tariq Madud's interview on the crisis of secularism.
Secularism, yeah. Mm. And that was a fair while ago as well.
That was...
Sockrell one, Chester.
Yeah, so a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
I also found myself uncomfortable with Madud's pairing of moderate church and state. Madud barely mentions the potential abuses of power that are much more likely to occur when particular religions are given special privileges by the state. The histories of many so-called moderately secular countries are filled with incidents in which dominant religious groups colluded with civil power structures to force their worldviews on religious, racial, and cultural minorities. Although Madud suggests that civil governments should use religious groups to administer social problems and promote harmonious relations, I would be quite worried that these religious groups would then use civil power to hegemonically enforce their values on ideological minorities. This seemed to be common in Quebec, for instance, before the Quiet Revolution of the mid-20th century. Currently, German Catholics are also concerned with what the Catholic Church is doing with their state-mandated church taxes and the financial excesses that are being paid for with public tax dollars.
You know, the reason I picked that one was partly because the Tariq Madud one, I think, is quite a good interview, and it hasn't had the legs that some of the other ones had, despite being quite involved with a lot of ongoing debates, but also because it's critical. And,
yeah.
I like it when the comments...
I'd use the word hegemonic.
We always like that.
I guess my immediate reflection would always be... there's a tendency in discussions of secularism and in discussions of, say, state relationships with religion to make a sort of implicit distinction between moderate religions, which are okay to deal with, and extreme or fundamentalist ones, which shouldn't be dealt with. And I don't know.
Well, I wonder if we would find that the moderate religions are, of course, the ones we're used to and the ones that, our religion... Whereas the extreme ones don't tend to be our religion, do they? They tend to be people doing weird things that normal religious people and cultures don't do.
Well, it's just, yes, the hegemonic politics going on there of, you know, we'll deal with you if you're quite like us. If you conform to the system that's already there, you can enter a dialogue, but if you refuse to conform to the system, then the system will engage with you.
Yeah. So if you inherently reflect the ideology of the culture in which that religion exists, then you're moderate and acceptable. But if you are in opposition to it in any way, then you're an extremist and ought not to be dealt with.
Exactly. According to this view. Please do enter these debates. We'll try and do this from time to time. We'll not have time to do it every week, I'm sure. But just, you know, keep you posted.
Well, the runtime of the episode has been creeping up gradually over a few years. I think we should maybe just accept that 45 minutes is it's fine.
People can always stop listening after the interview if they want.
They probably do.
We are into December now, so Christmas, the bells are jingling. I should have brought some jingle bells with me. But time is running out to get on there and use our amazon.co.uk and .com links.
Well, it's not running out. I mean, you can still do it in the new year, but this particular window of power, yeah. You through no real effort, through two clicks, can do an enormous amount to help Chris and I do this, to help all the other people, to help this project continue to exist, at no expense to yourself. We are sorry that we have to keep banging on about this, but I'm sure that you all enjoy listening to this podcast for free, you know, using it in your teaching or your learning for free. Mm-hmm. Do us this favor, man. Go on.
And next week, you can continue that with our final theorist podcast, which is going to be Ivan Strensky. It's an interview I recorded with him on Durkheim, but also more broadly the Durkheimian school and its influence.
I haven't heard this yet, and I'm looking forward to it.
Good.
I really am. Well, I love all this theorist stuff. It's good.
Yeah.
It's like being back in second year.
It was brilliant chat, and a thoroughly welcoming book. So, for now,
thanks for listening.